Muy buenos días a todos. Soy María Arisa, directora de la Bolsa Institucional de Valores Viva. Estamos transmitiendo completamente en vivo desde nuestro auditorio, nuestro primer Viva Forum, así que bienvenidos a todos. Vamos a platicar durante los próximos 4 días de perspectivas de inversión, tendencias ESG en el mercado de valores, oportunidades en México después del COVID, tecnología y futuro en las bolsas de valores, y conversaremos con el gobierno sobre regulación. Antes de comenzar el panel el día de hoy, quiero comentarles un par de detalles sobre la transmisión del Viva Forum. Todos los paneles tienen traducción simultánea inglés-español, por lo que si ustedes desean escuchar nuestros paneles en cualquiera de estos dos idiomas, lo único que tienen que hacer es seleccionar en la parte inferior de su pantalla, justo al lado del módulo de preguntas y respuestas. Let me repeat that in English. All Viva Forum panels will have simultaneous English-Spanish translation. So if you want to listen to our panels in another language, all you have to do is select the language of your choice in the bottom bar of your screen, right next to the question and answer module. Speaking of which, at the end of the panel, we will have a space available for questions open to you, our audience, so that can be addressed by our panelists. So if you have any questions or comments during the panel, do not hesitate to write them in the question and answer module, and our guests will answer them at the end. Viva, the stock exchange I'm very honored to head, is committed to increase the debt, development, and democratization of the Mexican stock market, which in our country is still very small compared to the size and opportunity of our economy, and has been quite stagnant for several years now. Since Viva launched operations 2 years ago, we have been trying very, very hard, not stopping, trying to change this path. Facing difficult challenges in harsh environments, and so resilience is part of our nature, as well as innovation, technology, and agility. We are committed to contribute to the growth of the stock market through service, innovation, and the use of cutting-edge technology, attracting new companies of different sizes, as well as new investors to the stock market, making it broader and more inclusive. With competition, transaction costs are reduced, which include commissions, buying and selling spreads, execution, speed, and debt. It also ensures market continuity, giving greater security to participants. We believe that working towards a greater access to the stock market, both companies and investors that did not consider or were even aware of the stock market as an option of funding or investing, will necessarily generate greater economic growth, but we will need joint efforts. Despite the urgent challenges, a longer-term vision of all economic actors is necessary for all productive sectors in our country and in our region. In the unity of all of us relies the true opportunity, the true element of change in favor of the development not only of our region, but the global markets in general. So in that sense of change is that we have invited those economic leaders with long-term vision. I want to introduce my distinguished board panelists of today. Donald Huber is a Senior Vice President Portfolio Manager at Franklin Equity Group, Franklin Templeton Institutional, responsible for managing institutional and retail global large-cap equity portfolios. Mr. Huber also serves as the investment team's dedicated ESG coordinator. Juan Frank is the Investment Director at SoftBank Mexico. Juan has been investing in Mexico at Temasek before, a Singaporean investment company based in Mexico City, focused on technology, consumer, retail, and healthcare spaces. Pablo Riverol, he's the head of Latin America Equities and head of Emerging Markets Research at Schroders, responsible for all Latin America and Brazilian equity funds. And Miguel Machado, he's the global head of equity research at Santander. Miguel's experience in the equity business spans over 20 years across several functions, including research, sales, and trading. So, let me start with my panelists with a broader global view, if you may. And of course, the first obligated question is around the current situation. I will start with you, Miguel. What changes will COVID-19 bring in terms of financial markets and stock markets? What do you envision?
Thanks, thanks, Maria, and thanks for the invitation to a great panel, and congratulations on the event. So I guess really, I mean, it's really no surprise that COVID will bring very long-term impacts in the way we live and the way we work and the way we travel, and of course then the way we invest, right? I think it's critical for anyone sitting today with an investment portfolio to actually be able to identify what these changes are going to mean for different sectors or different countries, right? I think there are some trends that were already well underway. I mean, we talk about digital transformation in many sectors, and I mean, some of those come to mind fairly easily. So banking was one of them, e-commerce was one of them. But clearly, I mean, these trends that we were already seeing, we've seen a dramatic acceleration of the digital transformation trend, and of course this will benefit some players over others. For instance, I know, I mean, just some of the sectors that come to mind, adoption of online groceries during the pandemic have almost tripled, right, in developed countries, from maybe the low teens to over 30%. I mean, these are some things that are not going to go away. Working from home went from 5% in the UK and the US to actually over 50% with the pandemic. Now, of course, I mean, we're not expecting for working from home trends to actually stay at the levels that we are seeing today, because we're still in the midst of the pandemic. But certainly the way we work is going to be completely different, and that is going to affect several sectors, right? So I'm thinking here probably, of course, the winners. We've already mentioned some of them. E-commerce is a clear winner. Logistics is a clear winner. But then there are some that are going to suffer quite significantly. I can think of some of the businesses that are dependent on traffic, right? To the extent that we stay at home and we don't go out, we're not gonna consume as much as we were consuming prior to the pandemic, because we're just not on the streets, right? So I think it's critical for anyone investing now to keep in mind what the impact long term is going to be about with those trends. I think there's also going to be a change in perception of risk, right? A shift towards stronger balance sheets, that's for sure. But then again, I mean, the way we thought about business diversification in January of this year is probably different than what we think of diversification right now. Take, for instance, I mean, a company that was very well, I don't know, diversified geographically. And then the pandemic comes, and it doesn't really matter if you're in the wrong sector. If you're in hospitality, it doesn't really matter if you are geographically diversified. So I think it's increasingly going to be important to first of all identify the big trends that are going to that are here to stay after COVID, and second, I think the investment community in general is going to change their views on how diversification works and risk perception overall. So I think, I mean, those are going to be the big trends, and this is going to impact how we invest going forward, right? That specifically to the equities asset class. I don't know if that answers your question, Maria.
We'll talk about the other asset classes afterwards. Thank you, Miguel. Let's continue with Pablo. Let's just imagine for a second that COVID has already ended. What do you foresee, Pablo? How would you allocate your portfolio for the following year between equities, fixed income, commodities, real assets? What do you see?
Okay, Maria, thanks a lot for the invitation, and thanks a lot to Beaver for organizing this panel. That's a nice thought. That would be a nice thing to imagine, and I like the optimism. I think, I mean, when we think about COVID having ended, we have to think about some of the trends that Miguel was mentioning, and how has the world changed, and what trends were already happening that would go back into play. So when you think about diversifying a portfolio, I mean, my responsibility is to invest in equities, but even within equities, we can pick our asset classes in a way. I think that, I mean, within equities, you need to think about structural growth. You need to think about sectors that can grow independently of economic growth, because economic growth is likely to be weak. I think the recovery will take time, and we will be surprised of how long it takes to get back to where we were. So if you can find structural growth stories, then invest in them, back them for the long term. And so would I see equities as an inflation hedge. There's some cyclical recovery to be played. There's a lot of people recommending to invest into value and looking at value. We have also been, you know, trying to find where to invest there. And I think that, I mean, the recovery won't be strong enough to get all value forward. People might be disappointed on how long it takes to see some of those cyclical sectors come back. So I would be relatively cautious. When you think about fixed income, I mean, rates were coming down and have already massively fallen across the world. When the Fed has pretty much promised that even if inflation comes back, they will not be raising rates for a while. There's been a ton of money being printed by central banks. So far, no signs of inflation, but eventually that will come. So I think this is a time to be borrowing money if you can secure a long-term fixed rate, not to be investing in fixed income. Then commodities is a difficult one. I mean, we've already seen a big recovery in some of the cyclical commodities. So copper, zinc, iron ore have done quite well. Now, I would be quite cautious of supply. Some commodities like oil have a lot of supply that as soon as there's a bit of demand recovery, we will see more supply coming. And that can be seen in Saudi Arabia, that can be seen in Russia, in all the progress that the US shale industry has done in terms of becoming more efficient. So that's an issue. One area of commodities where we've spent a lot of time over the past couple of years has been understanding what commodities will help energy transition around the world, and how can we invest in them. There are some that stack up well, copper, high-grade nickel, for example. Lithium also seems to be very well placed, but there's a lot of it. So again, going back to supply, I would be cautious there. And finally, on your question on real assets and I would link that to gold as well. I mean, there has been a lot of money printed around the world. And normally, if a country was doing it single-handedly, you would see a big depreciation of their currency or inflation. Since everyone is doing it in a way, it's been harder to know exactly, you know, where will the depreciation come from, as it's a relative game. And there's no sign of inflation in the traditional sense of the word, because there's no demand, so there's no one to push prices up. However, all of this money printing is creating bubbles and creating inflation in certain asset classes. Gold is probably the main one, Bitcoin for the adventurous, but also we're seeing bubbles in some commodity, in some equity markets, and I think real assets as well. I mean, interesting. House prices in the US are going up. In the UK, where I'm based, for everyone's surprise, prices are going up. So I think that some of that money printing will make its way to real assets. So I would have exposure to them as well.
Right. Could you further a little bit on the emerging market opportunity? How do you see it?
Sure. I mean, I think in emerging markets, we have we have two main traits. One is the structural growth part of the economy, which I think is the most exciting one. So when you think about these new businesses, new economy, whether it's e-commerce, fintech, edtech, healthcare innovation, agricultural innovation, you not only get the growth because of that technology coming through, but also because of the low penetration and the huge benefits that can have. So I think that part of emerging markets is extremely exciting, and some companies are getting it right. And companies like SoftBank are backing some of these businesses aggressively. There's another part, which is a more cyclical one, which is, you know, we've just seen a collapse in global growth, collapse in trade, commodity prices got hit, and now we're starting to see demand come back. And as exports recover, you will see a cyclical play. But that on that side of the emerging markets, I would be somewhat more cautious. And finally, on currencies and some fixed income assets within emerging markets, I mean, risk premiums are high. So there's some pockets of value around. And there is a potential recovery in some currencies that have solid backing, especially with countries with good balance sheets, which there aren't that many after the amount of fiscal deficits that have been run this year.
Great. Very insightful. Thank you, Pablo. Don, what do you think will be the trend that global large cap equity portfolios will follow in the next year?
Well, first, thank you, Maria. I'm happy to participate in the forum today, and congratulations. You know, I'd say looking out over the next 12 to 18 months, I think it's reasonable that we start to see some kind of return to normal, both in the real economy and in pockets of the market that have been most severely hit by the pandemic. So areas like brick and mortar retail, for example, you begin to see the stores open up, you begin to see improved earnings. I think even travel to a certain extent begins to come back, although clearly a longer tail in 3 to 4 years, really in our estimation, till you see anything like return to travel like we had in 2019. I'd say since the spring, there have been three drivers to watch driving the equity markets, and you can almost see it on a daily basis. And I think over the longer term, in its next 12 months, they will continue to be the drivers for the market. The first is the science, the success of healthcare companies in developing both treatments for COVID in order to lessen the severity, bring down the death rate, decrease hospitalization or the time for hospitalization, as well as development of a vaccine. And clearly that's what we're watching, that the vaccine is clearly ultimately what is required. And I think, the markets to some extent will continue to trade as news flow comes out on a daily and monthly basis in terms of the development of these treatments. The second is clearly the success of public health policies in bending the curves. And we've seen some initial successes. I think, you know, areas of Asia with the experience of Southeast Asia with the experience of past epidemics, a bit more successful than the rest of the world who hasn't had this experience, but I think we're learning quickly. As we're seeing curves kind of go up in parts of the States and parts of Europe again, it's not for lack of knowledge of what's required to control the pandemic. It's for weariness or just kind of feeling our way in terms of what degree of lifting up of the lockdowns works. So I think continue to follow that. And then the last thing that the markets are trading on, and I think continue to trade on, is the degree of fiscal and monetary stimulus. I think, you know, importantly, kind of taking a page out of the global financial crisis, or having learned from the global financial crisis, central banks and governments have been pretty quick in terms of putting in place stimulus. You know, we're seeing stimulus in the from the EU and the EC that on the monetary, or I'm sorry, on the fiscal side, that would have been unimaginable a couple of years ago. So I think that the direction for the markets, the direction for parts of the markets within global equities will continue to be driven by these factors. I think one important thing to remember as we look toward exiting from the pandemic, over the next series of months or years, is a comment that one of my fixed income colleagues pointed out early on, and that is that, you know, what we're in the midst of right now is really the economic equivalent of an artificially induced coma. You know, it wasn't from structural issues in the economy or in the markets that we landed here. It's really from public health policy to control the pandemic. So that doesn't mean that the economic damage that we're seeing right now isn't real, but again, it helps me to remember that the way out of this is clear, but again, it's tied to science.
Right. Thank you, Don. Thank you for those insights. And now I want to tap on a different kind of asset. Juan, what are your views on the recent performance of alternative, more risky assets such as tech-enabled companies? What do you think?
Thanks very much, Maria, and I echo my fellow panelists in thanking you for the invitation and also congratulating you on the start of a great event. So I think it's no secret that technology companies in general have outperformed in the current context, obviously given the strong tailwinds triggered by COVID in terms of accelerating the digital penetration story across the world. But I'd like to also comment on the fact that tech assets have been historically described as, quote, more risky. And I think what's happened in the last couple of months is that the market is realizing that there is a decoupling between the classification of tech companies or tech-enabled companies and high risk. Essentially, the perception of risk has changed across the investor base. And what I mean by that is historically, tech companies have been associated to more risk because they're usually challenger companies going against incumbents, sometimes losing money to do so and continue to grow, and therefore depending on the next capital raise to continue to grow. And what we've seen during the pandemic is that these business models are not only highly scalable and therefore present a lot of growth opportunities, but they're also extremely resilient in the current context. And so the best companies to weather this current crisis have actually been these companies that are tech or tech enabled, such as the retailer that had a good omni-channel strategy, or the healthcare group that already had good telemedicine capabilities, or the financial services firm that already had good remote access capabilities. At the end of the day, what the market is doing is assigning a lower cost of capital to these technology companies because they represent lower risk in this context. And so I think historically, when we looked at the market, we'd associate lower risk to infrastructure companies or companies that depended on kind of foreseeable cash flows. And I think what we're seeing today is that the companies that present the most foreseeable cash flows are the ones that are embracing technology and are actually benefiting from the tailwind that COVID is triggering. So I'd say that it's not only an operational outperformance that these tech companies are presenting, but it's also a decreasing cost of capital that's actually lifting the stock prices and the multiples of these tech companies or tech-enabled companies around the world.
Wow, that's so interesting. And I wanted to jump with you again and link my favorite topic, which is private equity to public equity. And I know you're very keen to the private equity world in Mexico. So what do you expect private equity to look like in the following year in an overall perspective? What do you think, Juan?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. And obviously, my answer will be somewhat biased given our mandate. But I think at the end of the day, private equity firms across the region will increasingly so focus on innovation and the secular trends that COVID has accelerated during the last 6 to 9 months. I think without a doubt, there are certain sectors that have already been mentioned in this panel that will continue to attract very large capital raisings, right? And those sectors are basically omni-channel retailing or e-commerce, software and software as a service, and fintech, obviously. But it's not only the companies that were digitally born or digitally native. I think a lot of companies that are operating in traditionally kind of brick and mortar industries that have embraced innovation and technology are also very well positioned to continue to grow in the current context. And so I think companies that have good team or push digital agenda and embracing innovation are also well suited. And I think I'd also say from the private equity perspective, when we look at portfolio management, again, I think at the board level, funds in general will continue to push management to focus on technology and adapt to this new context. And I think that will also bring a couple of interesting consequences. The first one is that companies will go out to the market to try to incorporate these new skill sets through M&A and consolidation, right? They'll go out and try to acquire either the people, the products, or the channels that historically they did not depend on, and that going forward will be prioritized. And so I think it's a combination of continuing to focus on innovation, continuing to ride the secular tailwinds that COVID is causing, and also consolidation in an M&A, I think will be key areas going forward.
Okay. And well, as we are in a stock exchange, I would like to see what are your thoughts on connecting private equity to a public equity world then, Don? How do you see the ecosystem relating to the exchange world?
You know, I think certainly traditionally we've thought of, and I still think of it this way, it's a symbiotic relationship, right? The innovation that Juan is talking about happens often in venture capital or private equity firms, kind of away from publicly traded markets demands. And then once matured or reaching a certain maturity stage, then the companies go public. And so the exit strategy has been historically on the VC and private equity side, taking the companies public and then, and then they're additive and that technology comes available to a broader group of investors. I think we've begun to see this change over the last few years. I think part of it is driven by interest rates. With low rates, pension plans have seen the present value of their liabilities increase and their expected return decrease. And so they've increasingly allocated to areas like venture capital and private equities, expecting higher returns. I think lower interest rates have made M&A more attractive. And so you've seen, IPOs as less of an exit strategy and more often companies being sold either to other private firms or to public firms. Which has kind of fueled another trend in the market, which is the big get bigger. There are fewer small firms and the large firms get larger. And it's also lower rates have also made acquisitions by private equity firms taking companies out of the market, clearly less expensive in terms of funding. And so I think when you combine that with the increased costs, whether technological cost or regulatory costs of bringing small IPOs out, you're seeing fewer exits done by an outright sale. And I recognize the work that BIVA is doing and other stock exchanges and regulators are doing to address this. But this is kind of where we are. But ultimately, as I see it, you know, the investments in private equity, the growing investments of private equity and venture capital are ultimately to the benefit of public companies. And so whether it's a, you know, directly coming out in as an IPO or whether it's a technology that becomes attractive, that's sold to another private firm and then ultimately they go public or is sold to a public company. I think this concept that the venture capital area, the private equity area is an area where this technology comes to fruition and then ultimately makes itself available for public investors continues to work as it has. Just kind of broadly speaking, just with a few minor modifications is in that we're seeing some kind of lower, that we're seeing larger IPOs or IPOs that are done effectively just by larger companies in the market making the acquisitions. So for the companies that we invest in, large and mid-cap type companies, I think we're still seeing the benefit of these investments. It's just, you know, more frequently we're seeing companies just bought directly from venture capital and typically at a later stage.
Okay, thank you. Juan, you have a track record in connecting high growth potential companies and investors with stock market. How can you, if you can share with us some of the good practices and efforts you have been doing within the last years that we can, you know, adapt in our environment? What do you propose that we change or that we adapt?
So I think, from our private equity perspective, when we think about the relationship between the public markets and high growth companies, we focus on three main aspects, Maria. The first one is just having strong founders supporting by a deep management bench around them, corporate governance, and then growth combined with a path to profitability, if not profitability. So on the first angle, which is strong founders supported by a strong management team, I think what we're trying to do is really show the world that there are plenty of extremely skilled and probably one of the best founder pool set in the world in Latin America that are used to scaling businesses in very adverse conditions, be it low access to financing, high inflation, macro and political uncertainty, etc. We think all of those kind of adverse characteristics in the environment produce the best entrepreneurs in the world. And that's what we're trying to find and back at SoftBank in Latin America. But it's not only about the founders. It's also about the team that supports them. So once we invest in these companies, we actively support the founders and really finding the best executives at a global scale to surround these founders and then put them in front of potential public equity investors as they prepare to go from a private company to a public company. The second angle is corporate governance. After investing, we focus a lot on the corporate governance perspective, and especially in our late stage companies, we make sure that from a corporate governance perspective, we have the checks and balances in place to allow for that company to go to the market in the short term. And that usually involves a couple of different characteristics. It involves having independent board members on the board, composing different subcommittees of the board that cover risk, audit, compensation, ESG, and obviously a backdrop of proper financial disclosure is what really prepares you for the public markets. And then finally, in terms of high growth tech companies in the region, you usually have to have a clear path to profitability. And so what we invest in as growth investors in the region is basically companies that are not necessarily profitable at the consolidated level, but have proven strong unit economics. And so basically what we do as part of our investment is provide the capital to continue to replicate those strong unit economics that continue to scale the business and eventually allow that that business to reach the scale that dilutes the fixed costs and gets the company to a consolidated profitable level. And so I think that path to profitability, as you think about going to the public markets, is key. So again, I'd summarize by saying very strong caliber founders supported by strong executives around those founders, a key focus on corporate governance, and then combining not only high growth in the region, but also a clear path to profitability.
Well, those are very interesting ideas for the companies that are watching this interview, this Zoom. So path to profitability, founders, executive team, and what was the fourth one, Juan?
A strong focus on corporate governance.
Corporate governance. So we'll go back to corporate governance in a while. But let's just switch a little to Mexico and Latin America, if you may. Pablo, I want your views. Looking Mexico from abroad, how is it Mexico looking as an option to invest in 2021? What does it have to happen for Mexico to increase the appetite for investors? What factors do you consider we need to focus on?
I think Mexico has been quite an interesting one in terms of how the country has dealt with the current pandemic, because I think most policymakers had, simplifying things, two main choices: either spend a lot of money supporting the economy, protecting jobs, protecting small companies, or protecting public finances, protecting the currency, and letting the economy sort of deal with it. And clearly Mexico has gone for the second option. And you can see this with, the fiscal deficit that is expected for this year. It's about 3%, maybe a bit more on the broader definition, but a fraction of the 10, 15% deficit that we're seeing in many other countries. On the other hand, you're seeing the economy shrinking maybe 10% plus this year. That has been together with a monetary policy that has also been somewhat in contrast with what we've seen in other markets. So many other countries have taken rates as low as they can be, 25 basis points in Peru, 50 basis points in Chile, all developed markets, obviously, as low as they can get. And Mexico, we still have some relatively hawkish central bank. So what does that mean? That has been actually quite good for the currency. It's supportive for the currency, and it's also supportive for sovereign debt and sovereign linked debt. If you put that together with a current account surplus that Mexico has, partly because of import contraction, if you take into account that the US is performing strongly, remittances are flowing in very very strongly into Mexico. Again, you have a fairly well supported currency and probably a fixed income trade, especially on the sovereign. Now, what we're starting to see, and I think the next move is, when do you move from that into equities and into a more cyclical recovery? And we're starting to see some indication that things are stabilizing. Cement companies are starting to talk about stronger demand, trying to push prices up. The banks are actually also starting to surprise positively, talking about seeing the light at the end of the tunnel and passing a more positive message. So I think we are getting to a point where a more cyclical recovery is a bit more evident, and that should come that should come through. Now, one thing to consider is that these different policies are quite relevant for long-term impact. So the reason why a lot of companies try to protect companies and jobs, why other governments try to do this, is because once a job is lost, once a company shuts down, it's quite hard to get it back on its feet. It's hard to get the employees. They might not be available anymore. Your suppliers might not be giving you the terms that they used to. The bank that funded you or the equity investors that funded you, you know, might think twice before they do it again. And hence, it can have a long-term impact in terms of confidence. And hence, the recovery might be slower. And I think it is in contrast with what we're seeing in other markets where the recovery is much more evident, much more widespread. So I'd say we're looking for that, but we haven't quite seen it. We do have a quantitative model to help us remove any home bias I might have. And Mexico is looking average. It's not a standout as appealing, but it has been improving in the rankings of our model. And things like valuation, and growth are starting to look somewhat better. So those would be, I think, the shorter term things that we would consider.
Pablo, us in Mexico, you know, we do believe things are more negative. We always see it, you know, all negative, all investors going away. So to hear you that there is a light at the end of the tunnel for investors abroad, it's sometimes in some way easing. So thank you, I hope there these opportunities come around for us in Mexico. And Miguel, in that sense, what is your perception regarding the flow of international clients to Mexico? What do you have to do?
I think Pablo's view clearly gives us an indication where institutional investors internationally are with regards to investing in Mexico, right? But I think there's also the need to actually differentiate between different asset classes. So, I mean, on the fixed income side, I would say especially government bonds in local currency have had very strong performances in the last few months. And given where rates are, given the monetary policy stance where we are now, and the expectation that the easing cycle is nearly over, and actually where we are compared to other emerging markets, I believe that flows into this sort of fixed income government bonds, especially denominated in pesos, will actually continue. I guess the one silver lining, and this is also something that Pablo was talking about, the one silver lining to the lack of stimulus that we've seen in the economy since the pandemic began back in March, is that our fiscal deficit looks much better than other EMs and actually other developed markets. So Mexico will look better than other countries from a fiscal deficit perspective. But the problem, of course, is that it's not going to be the same in terms of a growth profile. So, I mean, you see the growth expectations for GDP for Mexico this year, and I mean, we are in pretty bad shape compared to other markets where stimulus has been plentiful, and so you have that you have to balance these things out, right? What's the good balance in terms of a fiscal deficit versus growth potential this year, and then potential recovery next year? Because of course, as Pablo also pointed out, I mean, there could be a point where destruction is so bad that you don't have businesses to actually pick up next year when the pandemic is stabilizing. So that's a big concern. Now, in that respect, what I would say is, I would expect flows into fixed income assets and especially government bonds denominated in pesos to continue, because on a relative basis, Mexico looks really good in terms of yield. Now, the problem there, of course, is that these flows are very fickle, and they can turn on a dime. So basically, when that turns, or if we keep on on decreasing rates, then that I guess that advantage disappears. On the equity side, what I would say is we need to think about the effect of the allocation of global emerging markets funds between countries. LATAM as a whole, I think, and this is not a new trend. I think if we look at this trend over the last 20 years, LATAM as a whole and Mexico specifically have been seeing allocations drop to maybe, I mean, I don't have the exact numbers, but I would venture to say that weightings in Mexico are 20% of what they were 20 years ago, right? In terms of allocation, in percentage allocation for emerging markets. Now, what this tells us is this points to an underperformance that LATAM and Mexico have had versus other emerging markets in terms of structural changes and in terms of growth profile. So I guess the key here is how we reverse that trend. What does the country need to do to actually attract flows that are long term? You don't want to necessarily attract the flows that will be leaving the country next year when our rate profile or our yield profile changes. You want to have those flows that actually stay in the country that generate employment that are more linked to foreign direct investment and I guess at this point I'm sure my colleagues in the panel will probably intervene here, but what we need to make sure is that you have the right policies in place to actually attract that foreign direct investment and you have the right framework in terms of investment, in terms of rule of law, in terms of policy that will actually give certainty and confidence for international investors to come back. You
know? Totally, totally right, and I totally agree with you. We need certainty. We need trust of our investors, and solid economics to look forward for opportunity. So I couldn't agree more with you. In that sense, Pablo or Juan or Don, how do you see the regulatory ambience in Mexico? What do you think we need to push forward?
Maybe I'll start. I mean, I think just before I go into that, one thing that I was thinking, going back to your first question, Maria, about where to invest in emerging markets and why we think it's exciting about emerging markets, all these new economy businesses. One of the issues with Mexico is that they're not really represented in the stock market. So fintech, e-commerce, education, a lot of that, the value is being generated in the private markets. And it would be great. And I guess eventually those businesses will come to the market. But currently, if you want to access them, it's either through private equity or through multinationals, so call it Mercado Libre, Amazon, etc. So having access to it would clearly be positive. In terms of governance, I think there is a need to shake up some of the C-level and the boards in the Mexican establishment of corporates. It is heavily, I won't generalize, but a lot of companies do have very, very old style governance and boards. We were looking at one big company recently that had, six of the board members were plus 80 years old. Five of them were in multiple boards. Seven of them have been in the board for more than 15 years, clearly not independent anymore, 100% men. So, I mean, you can't take that seriously in terms of diversity of thought. So I think we do need more women and more.
Thank you. Thank you, Pablo. I couldn't agree more with you. I totally agree. Well, totally.
Yeah. So anyway, small changes. And now finally on your question about the rule of law. I mean, I think it is the long-term essential is to have institutions that work, checks and balances to the government and the different regulatory agencies that work, rule of law. So that is something that you cannot take for granted, but the lack of it or the weakening of institutions will have a cost in, at the end of the day, making financing for Mexican companies much more expensive.
Right. Thank you, Pablo. Don, what would be your recommendations moving forward in making capital work for companies and investors?
Yeah, I think, broadly speaking, what companies need to do, and this hasn't changed over time, is from our perspective, is they need to incorporate some sort of EVA, economic value added analysis, or shareholder return analysis when they're making investments. It sounds fairly straightforward and ubiquitous, but it's not done broadly by a number of people. For us as growth investors, we want to be invested in companies that are growing, not just for the sake of growing, but for the sake of providing shareholder value in the process. And we want to see that kind of discipline in their investment decisions. And so we've looked at companies that are growing by acquisition and in the process getting bigger, but destroying shareholder value. And that to us as growth investors just isn't sustainable. I think you're seeing this kind of analysis play out in an interesting way in the e-commerce space, particularly related to distribution and fulfillment. Amazon, kind of the huge gorilla in this space, has been able to make investments, buying warehouses, buying planes, buying trucks, a number of kind of asset heavy type investments. And they've been able to fund that, through the resources coming from the AWS, their cloud computing platform. Other e-commerce companies, newer e-commerce companies, companies that aren't as large, that don't have this AWS supporting them, have had to be more nimble in terms of the way they're making decisions. And so on the one hand, while you have Amazon raising the standard for fulfillment and bring people to expect two-day delivery at the slowest, and whether or not a consumer is in a country that's served by Amazon or is just aware that that kind of service is available elsewhere in the world, it's raised the bar for every e-commerce company delivering goods to a consumer. And so we've seen companies being more nimble, Mercado Libre in Latin America, Shopify, a Canadian company that's a global infrastructure business for e-commerce companies, have been more nimble. They're not buying warehouses, they're renting or leasing warehouses, they're investing in software to manage the warehouses. They're really becoming logistics companies in an asset light way or in a technologically driven way. And that, I think, is an example of some smart investments that these firms are making that increase their addressable market, increase their market share, but do it in a very smart way in terms of the limited capital that they're having to deploy. And that's what we really need to see, just more broadly speaking, in companies and putting capital work and making it work not only for the companies, but then for the investors as well.
Right. Thank you, Don. Juan, I've been asked this for several times. What do you think can be attributed to the record IPOs we've seen in other countries like Brazil or the United States, despite the volatility and uncertainty in the markets right now? What should be corrected in Mexico so that we can follow that path?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because there's definitely been a decoupling again between the financial markets and the real economy across the region and the globe. And I think there's a couple of factors that explain that. The first one I would say is that there's a large component of tech-enabled or tech growth in a lot of these IPO growth stories, right? You have companies going to the market that are growing at high double digits or even triple digits year-over-year growth because of an acceleration of the digital story, right? What these companies were expecting to do in 3 years, they're doing in 3 to 6 months. And again, going to my first answer at the beginning of the panel, they also present extremely resilient business models in this type of context. So there's definitely an operational angle that justifies the IPOs going to market. But I think there's also two kind of macro trends. Obviously, the first one is low interest rates and what my fellow panelists were referring to in terms of the Fed promising to keep rates low for the foreseeable future is obviously a very strong tailwind for the equity markets in general. Investors are eager for yield, and IPOs, especially in the tech space, have turned out to be quite profitable in investments on the IPO side. And then what you also have is an interesting local dynamic, specifically in Brazil, right? As interest rates have continued to go down, you have Brazilian interest rates at historical lows, and therefore you have local investors cycling out of fixed income investments into equity investments, right? And so I think a continuously expanding retail investment landscape is also very much helping these IPO stories get to market. I was reading this week that when you look at the foreign participation in IPOs in Brazil, in 2019, it was around 50%. In 2020, year to date, it's around 24%. So definitely the local participation from both institutionals and retails are pushing these IPO stories. And so when you look at Mexico, I think there's a couple of things that we can learn. The first one is that a expanding and sophisticated retail investor base is key to continue to develop the IPO story in Mexico, which I think there's only been one IPO in the last 3 years. And then I think with investors like ourselves continuing to fund private companies that have high growth, will continue to populate the pipeline of potential IPOs in the next 24 to 36 months, which I think historically is another big obstacle that Mexican entrepreneurs have faced as they've scaled their businesses in Mexico, right? The scarce access to Series B plus funding. So again, I think if we see in Mexico a healthy pipeline of private equity companies being funded and then complemented by an expanding retail investor base, I think the IPO story going forward can be optimistic.
Oof, I just completely agree with you. Do you see SoftBank coming to with an IPO soon in Mexico? Say yes.
I think we're optimistic. I think we're very proud of the fact that we participated in the first homegrown Mexican unicorn that was announced a couple of weeks ago, which is Kavak, which is a digital platform for buying and selling used cars, like Carvana or Vroom in the US. And I think that's a key milestone for all of us in the VC ecosystem. There's a lot of people that supported that company to reach that milestone. And I think it's a parteaguas, as we say in Spanish, right? It's a milestone that will hopefully open the door for other tech companies to reach that milestone and eventually aspire to go to the public markets in the next 24 to 36 months. And I don't think we'd be investing in the region and specifically in Mexico if we weren't optimistic that that were the case.
Thank you so much. We would love to have Quebec or any other of those companies in Viva soon so that we can attract more retail investors. I think that's that's key. If we want to grow our base, our retail base, we need companies, innovative companies to come to markets and attract everybody. Let me finish this round with a question. If you have to choose one Latin country, which one would it be? Don.
Sorry, I need to find the mute button. You know, I think for us, with coming from where we are with our strategy, which is a concentrated global strategy, investing in 35 to 40 companies or 20 companies. And looking at the globe as our opportunity set, we tend to focus on the larger markets. And so in terms of kind of single country exposure, it would either be Mexico or Brazil, in the markets. But really, for most of our companies, they're either global businesses or pan-Latin American, pan-Asian, pan-European investments. So our investment in Latin America right now is through a pan-Latin American company, Mercado Libre, as described.
Okay. Juan?
Yeah, I would say, look, we're not in the business of picking geographies, but picking entrepreneurs and companies. But having said that, just on Don's point, from a perspective of scale, I am on a team that's looking to invest around $5 billion of capital in the region in growth equity companies. And when you think about that scale, the two countries that automatically pop up in the region are Brazil and Mexico. From a tech maturity point of view, from a spectrum of tech companies available out there to invest, and then capital available generally, I think Brazil will continue to represent the bulk of our investments as it's done so far. I think around 70% of our exposure is in Brazil, and then 30% is scattered across Mexico, Colombia, and Argentina. Now, having said that, I think it's important to say that the Brazilian unicorns that were created in the past 4 to 5 years, right, the Stones, the Bags Seguros of this world, were also created in a context of macro and political uncertainty in Brazil, right? And through a couple of years where we saw a pretty deep recession in Brazil. And so I think it's important to highlight that, because at the end of the day, these growth stories are quite isolated from the macro and political uncertainty. And I think in that context, I'm quite optimistic that certain growth stories in Mexico in the next 24 to 36 months will actually be very, very successful. And you'll see them going out to the market in that time frame. So I guess I'd summarize by saying that by definition, Brazil will continue to represent the bulk of our exposure, but I'm optimistic that Mexico will start to catch up quite soon.
Great. Pablo?
Yeah, I mean, when we look at the region, I think one, if we're looking for a clear evidence of an economic recovery, access to new economy, structural growth businesses, and market depth, and that is liquidity, liquidity and a broad exposure to several of these sectors. Brazil is by far the most appealing option for us. I mean, I agree with the comments that Juan was making. I mean, we've spent a lot of time, probably wasted a lot of time forecasting economic GDP growth and meeting political consultants. And the truth is that, I mean, good businesses that can really scale up can do it in spite of uncertainty, as long as as long as regulations exist and there's a rule of law. But I mean, that, given that, you can actually see through all the noise. Now, the other interesting point about and trying to explain why is this group of new businesses coming out more often in Brazil than in Mexico. I think it's also partly cultural and partly there's a very, very strong entrepreneurial ecosystem. An interesting point to look at is, for example, if you take the top 50 companies in Mexico today and 20 years ago, the names won't have changed much, or the 50 wealthiest people, whichever one you want. If you do the same for Brazil, it's actually a very different list. Fortunes get made and lost through time, and there is mobility in that sense, which is very healthy. So for now, it would be Brazil, but I think that those areas of more representation of these businesses in the public markets in Mexico, more retail participation as well, and more market depth. We liquidity is a constraint for some of our funds. Would be a big catalyst for Mexico.
Yeah, we need to work on that for sure. Miguel, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not going to add anything substantially different that wasn't already said here. I think, I mean, in terms of choosing a country, I think scale and access to a diversified set of sectors would point to Brazil being probably the best option to invest in Latin America, right? We actually have or our strategist at Santander actually has an overweight in Brazil and an equal weight in Mexico. So just comparing those two markets. But again, I mean, there are good opportunities in Brazil for real assets, in utilities, in real estate, in infra. Most sectors are well represented, including tech, which is a big theme globally. And of course, I mean, the retail aspect of it is important, but it's not only the retail side. It's also what we've seen in the equitization of the economy, right? I mean, you see the trend in rates in Brazil, and over the last, I mean, over the last 10 years, I mean, we've dropped. I mean, from rates being at 12% to rates being at 2%, right? That has a huge impact in the equitization of the economy. In the search for yield, I mean, there's either you go into equities or you find a different alternative asset, but it cannot you cannot continue to invest in fixed income assets in Brazil if you're searching for yield, right? So, I mean, what this means in terms of inflows into equities from locals is billions, is tens of billions of dollars on an annual basis. So basically, I think that's also very important, right? So just the fact that the market is more diversified, that all sectors are well represented in the market, the liquidity aspects that Pablo was mentioning, and the fact that we've really seen a secular trend into equitization of the economy, I think are critical for that, right? So I think, I mean, if I had to choose one country in Latin America today, regardless of the fiscal deficit angle, and that will probably translate into a concern next year, I think we're at a point in time where that probably is already discounted in the currency, but the secular trend of equitization in the economy is here to stay. So I would favor Brazil over Mexico. Now that being said, I think there are some value plays in Mexico. The market clearly is a defensive market by nature. We've seen that in the changes in the earnings revisions that we've seen lately in the Latin American markets. Mexico points to actually be a pretty defensive in the composition of the index. So I guess Mexico would be a second place there.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions from the audience. One is open for whomever wants to take it. It says, one of the topics mentioned is innovation and digital penetration. However, we in the fintech space have seen that there is a strong demand for it, particularly in emerging markets, but have also seen that there is not much capital available to make investments. What is the take of the panelists on where financial institutions are investing?
So I can start with that if you want. And I'd say I'd agree in the sense that strategics have not made giant leaps yet in terms of fintech investments. I think you're starting to see a couple here and there. And I think the COVID context will only accelerate the need to develop fintech capabilities. And like I said at the beginning, I think there will be consolidation at the end of the day. When you look at Mexico generally, I think there's around 80 plus fintech licenses in the pipeline to be approved. And I don't think, obviously, all of them will be successful at the end of the day, but I do think all of them bring something to the table in terms of human talent, interesting channels, interesting product or interesting tech to make them consolidation targets. I think the absence of strategic investment into the space is being today replaced by financial investment into the space, right? And I think names like SoftBank, Tencent, DST, General Atlantic, et cetera, are all across the region making quite substantial investments in the space. And I think the opportunity is extremely interesting, right? I think we all know the stats around the underbanked sector and how the government is actually also pushing a very financial inclusiveness agenda that is only powered by fintech, right? So I think fintech is one of those verticals that align a couple of different angles, right? It's a huge sector with a big opportunity that's inefficient today, and that from a regulatory perspective, everyone is aligned in trying to expand financial services to the underserved population of the region. So I think we'll continue to see investments in the space, specifically coming in the short term from financial investors, but eventually I think strategic investors will also get there.
Super. Good news for fintechs. Maybe Don, you want to take this one. SPACs are booming in the United States stock market. What is needed in Mexico to see the same thing here? Do you have any ideas?
I have thoughts, at least from our standpoint, on SPACs in general, which are that they are a fascinating investment opportunity to invest in in an individual or a group of individuals based on their expertise. The idea for me as a global investor to invest in a group of businesses where you have no visibility into what those businesses are today, and you're doing it solely based on the track record of the investors behind it, is not something that I find, that I think is tremendously appealing. I think it's a sign of where rates are and the liquidity in the market and where investor risk appetites are right now. But it'll be very interesting to see how successful these things are over time and whether this is a phenomenon that continues. But I don't see it. For most investors, I think you'd much rather know what you're buying, know the profitability, know the corporate governance, very importantly, than invest in really what's almost literally a blind pool.
Right. And let me just touch on a question that I put you in the set of questions I sent you about the current situation of elections in the United States. How do you, anyone who wants to take it, how do you see the situation? How do you see the tendencies? Do you think, what candidate do you think is going to be more beneficial? What about volatility, everything regarding the next couple of months?
Yeah, Maria, if you want, I can take a first stab at this. A change in U.S. policies might lead to an easing of global trade tensions. That's clear. That could actually potentially fuel, I guess, outperformance in non-U.S. equity markets. And of course, this also means that the reduction in trade tensions with China could actually hinder Mexico's ability to attract FDI, which, as we pointed out in the last set, we think is very, very, very important, right? But I think, Biden's platform includes some higher taxation, which might reflect negatively and affect U.S. equity markets. But I believe probably concerns around this are probably overblown because in the short term, I don't think that higher taxation would be implemented. I guess fiscal policy should continue to be supportive of the economy. And in fact, it could even become more aggressive with the Democrats winning, or if the Democrats win, right? Ultimately, I think, in my view, the performance of the Mexican economy is really a lot more dependent on the actions that the current Mexico administration takes, and not necessarily U.S. politics, right? So, I think, in the medium term, regardless of what happens with U.S. elections, I think Mexico has to solve their own internal problems, and I don't think there's a dramatic difference between a Trump win and a Biden win.
Pablo, what do you think? Do you see it that this way?
I mean, there's been a lot of discussions of what candidate is better for markets. There's a group of people that think, well, Trump has been good for markets, has brought taxes down, has stimulated the economy, has reduced regulation, and hence a changing government would undo that and hence be bad for markets. There was also a lot of fear about Trump being bad for Mexico because of his campaign. And at the end of the day, it hasn't been that bad. The NAFTA, USMCA, pretty similar. The U.S. economy is doing well, and that helps Mexico. When we think about, when we analyze Democrat versus Republican governments and their impact on the economy and the stock market, there isn't a clear relation of who does better. I mean, the Republicans cut taxes, but the Democrats also like spending, just in a slightly different way, through more infrastructure, maybe just rebalancing the expenditure towards a different area. So I don't think there's a very big difference there. I do think that easing of trade tensions would help. Mexico, at the end of the day, is a very open economy that needs exports to really drive growth. So hopefully that can come back. Biden also has quite a green agenda that has been somewhat neglected by the current U.S. government. So if you bring back incentives towards electric vehicles, make the life slightly harder for the oil sector, that could actually accelerate energy transition, and Mexico is not particularly well placed for that. But at the end of the day, I think that ignoring the volatility of around the elections and how long it takes to know who the winner actually was, we don't see that as a major mover for Mexican markets.
Okay. Don, any ideas on this? Trump or Biden?
Sure. I think, looking at it from a really global standpoint, I think, some of the volatility, as Pablo mentioned, it's around the question of, will there be a peaceful handover, which our president has not committed to doing. And so I think that's added to some volatility and likely to persist after the election, given the number of people who will have voted by mail-in ballots. I think ultimately that will be sorted out. I think the other concern is but this has really already been incorporated into the markets, is a concern about a strong shift leftward. To the extent that there's a blue sweep and the Democrats gain not only the presidency, but the Senate, and have all three parts of Congress and the presidency. And this is fueled by the rise of the popularity of the what some call the radical left, or Bernie Sanders camp. I think to have major change in policy outside the U.S. or in the U.S. and affecting the rest of the world, you'd really need to have a blue sweep, and with the Democrats gaining control. But even then, I think, it's ultimately going to be based on the size of the Biden mandate and the margin of the control that the Democrats have in the Senate. And I think both of those are up for question. I think, you know, kind of giving some comfort that the U.S. isn't moving to a radical left is, first of all, Biden is more of a centrist candidate. He's a conciliator. He's a negotiator. He's willing to work across the aisle. And I think he remembers what happened when Obama came in and, you know, very quickly put in his Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, healthcare. And then 2 years later, the Democrats lost control of the House of Representatives. And so I think he's very cautious about the direction and the pace that he'll move. I think in terms of changes that we can expect, broadly speaking, the tax, you know, in a Democratic sweep where the Democrats gain control, you know, clearly taxes on U.S. companies will go up. Taxes for some individuals, you know, middle income and below will likely go down. I think they, perhaps more importantly, from an economic standpoint, you'll see a broader program for economic stimulus that they're currently in the throes of negotiating right now. Probably likely an infrastructure plan. It's part of Biden's Green Deal, an infrastructure plan that the current administration hasn't been able to put in place. I think both of those will be good for the global economy. I don't think you see many changes in the U.S. healthcare system right away. Again, Biden's more of a centrist on this, you know, not a big global impact outside of healthcare companies and drug and biotech and pharmaceutical companies outside the U.S., but I don't think you see big changes. And then lastly, in terms of trade, it's interesting, you know, that we're thinking about trade policy when you know, envisioning the possible or likely shift of control from Republicans to Democrats, where the Republicans have historically been the party of free trade. And I think it's odd, but likely that you see more certainty, more stability in U.S. trade policy with the rest of the world, which I think is a positive. You know, I will caution that certainly in terms of relationships with China and concern about China trade policy and IP, that's actually a concern across the board, you know, through both parties. So I don't think you see a tremendous amount of working backwards and restrictions lifted. But I think certainly there's more visibility into the process of negotiating trade agreements and likelihood that they will be a bit more. I'm trying to think of the right word, a bit more logical and well thought out in terms of the process that we go through.
Super. Thank you, Don. I have a final question for Juan. I hope you can take it very, very quickly. Traditional multiples, such as enterprise value over EBITDA, price to book value, and other traditional approaches, such as DCF, doesn't seem to apply to a lot of rising tech companies. How do you identify where to find value in these companies, and how do you know when one of these companies may be in a valuation bubble?
That's a hard question to respond in 2 minutes. But I said this, there's a couple of things that we focus on, and I think Don was also referring to this when he talked about the e-commerce platforms across the world, right? Even though at a consolidated basis, these tech companies might not be profitable, you start to see signs that the path to profitability is actually believable, right? And that comes down to unit economics. And you can define unit economics in different ways, right? It's the lifetime value of the customer you're acquiring compared to the customer acquisition cost that you're investing to acquire that customer, or it's also how long it takes from a gross margin or contribution profit perspective to recuperate your CAC or customer cost of acquisition. And so we generally try to invest in companies that have the very strong and predictable unit economics. And that basically translates into LTV to CAC ratios of 3-4 times plus, depending on the type of consumer marketplace or B2B marketplace. And I think at the end of the day, if you invest in those type of growth opportunities and the management executes well, which is basically replicating what they're already doing at the unit economic level, you'll ultimately reach a scale where the company at a consolidated basis becomes profitable. And I think what's important also to think about when you look at historic valuations compared to where they are today is the cost of capital, right? It's not only the fact that these tech companies are growing quite handsomely, but it's also the fact that investors around the world, when they do their DCF analysis, are applying a cost of capital that we haven't seen in a very long time. And that ultimately also inflates valuations compared to historical metrics. So I'd say that the outperformance in terms of operations and growth complemented by the decreasing cost of capital is what is pushing your valuations up.
Thank you. Very insightful. So we've reached the end. In Mexico, like in most Latin America countries, the stock market has truly developed over the last 45 years. From 1974, when Mexico institutionalized the stock market with the publication of the Securities Market Law, to the adoption of market international standards, in particular for the registration of securities offered to the general public, to the professional development of corporate governance in Mexico, with an important improvement in legal and corporate framework for our public companies, to the transformation of a fully automated market to achieve greater transactional efficiency, to the advancement of the SIC, Sistema Internacional de Cotizaciones, to today. And so what's next? What is it for the future? What we envision is to facilitate an integrated scalability of the market, to favor access to financing and capital resources for companies at different stages, at different points of maturity, at different sizes. In Mexico and Latin America, it has been the collective understanding that the purpose of listing securities is always aimed to achieve investment by the public in general. And despite this understanding, we haven't been able to include more participants into the markets. And especially in Mexico, as Juan said, and Pablo said, we're illiquid. So experience has shown us, though, that there are other market niches that are not suitable for the general public, but institutional investment and qualified investors. Today, we have begun to develop these other niches, but perhaps not with all the infrastructure that is required, nor with the entire menu of useful tools for this. We have not designed, as has been done in other markets, integrated and scalable structures for the issuance of securities within the same stock exchanges. We believe that having differentiated issuance structures by market segments that would allow companies to develop according to their own needs and maturity and market opportunities is what Mexico needs. There are already some formulas out there to achieve this. However, none are either integrated, nor have the capacity to centralize the market or favor the price formation, organize the national aggregate supply and demand for securities, or offer issuers the scalability service to go for more as they grow and develop their capital or financial needs. Only stock markets can do this. We are able to centralize, organize, and integrate markets. The future should be a larger, deeper, transparent, trustworthy for investors and issuers, accessible, inclusive market that we can only assure. So we need to work on how to bring these formulas and apply them to the markets, which is in everyone's interest, and all market participants should have to play a role to achieve this. This is what would allow scalability. These are only a few of the main reasons why we at Viva, we are at the forefront of market development. We think that is one of the utmost important to keep on generating discussions like this one of today, where we seek to create important spaces for equity market insights by allowing encouraging ideas and different perspectives to be debated and enriched. We open up new paths, discover new areas of opportunities, and set in motion what works best for markets and trades. I would like to thank our panelists, Donald, Juan, Pablo, and Miguel, for joining us in this Viva Forum, Rethinking the Stock Markets in the 21st Century. It was such an amazing panel. Thank you so much, the four of you, for your insights. We invite you all to join us on the upcoming panels taking place at the same time, at the same place, all this week. Thank you.